Thank you for joining me. Today I have Dr. Joanna Moncrief. Dr. Moncrief, could you start by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, of course. Thanks, Daniel, for having me. So I'm a psychiatrist and a professor in London, in the UK, in University College London. And I've just published a book called Chemically Imbalanced. Here it is, about the serotonin, the theory that depression is caused by low serotonin, and our research showing that that's not the case. And I've been a longstanding, I've had a longstanding interest in psychiatric drugs, and been a longstanding critic of the overuse and misunderstanding of psychiatric drug treatment, including the use of antidepressants.
Good, thank you. Yeah, you were one of the authors behind that article that kind of went public all over the media not too long ago about the serotonin myth, right?
That's right. Yes. Yes. I was the lead author. I had put together a small team to look at all the research on all the main modern research that has explored connections between serotonin and depression. And we brought it all together in what's called an umbrella review, and concluded that there was really no compelling evidence from any of those areas of research that there was a link between low serotonin and depression.
Hmm. Yeah, I remember my father-in-law, he knows that me and my wife take an interest in this field, and he sent us that article when it came out, and he knew that. Right. So I'm sure for you, that must have been to be doing this work and then to have it publicized that widely, it must have been a good...
When? Yeah, it was really exciting, and it was also very interesting. So, you know, many members of the public were really genuinely shocked, because they had been led to believe that it was established that depression was linked with low serotonin. They didn't think it was just a theory, like it sort of technically says in the textbooks or we're taught in medical school. They thought it had been proven. And so they were shocked to find out that actually it hadn't been proven at all. That's why there was so much interest. And of course, many people had decided to take antidepressants on that basis, believing that they genuinely had a chemical imbalance in their brain and that taking an antidepressant would help put that right. And now they were just finding out that, in fact, you know, no such thing had ever been demonstrated, and that we have no idea really what antidepressants are doing to the brain, and therefore to the mind, or our, you know, mental activity and behavior and feelings. So that's where the public were interested and the media were interested. The psychiatric profession, of course, were very embarrassed, because they have known this for a while, but not publicized it and allowed the public to go on believing that this connection between serotonin and depression had been demonstrated when it hasn't. They were embarrassed. They tried to shut the debate down. They tried to discredit the research. They tried to discredit me. So that was also interesting to watch and interesting to reflect on why the idea that depression has biological roots is such an important idea for the psychiatric profession.
Yeah, I've seen some of that you're speaking to, where some of the argument goes that it wasn't psychiatrists who started this myth or this rumor. It was other people. Maybe we could have spoken up earlier or shut down that idea earlier. We didn't, and that's a mistake. But they do kind of brush it away, or not give you a whole lot of credence for that work and for getting it out there to the public, and actually the opposite, criticizing you for it.
Yeah, oh gosh, absolutely. You've become a hate figure since the publication. I mean, really, truly, truly. But I should say, so psychiatrists weren't responsible for promoting the idea, but they did conceive of it in the first place. So it was psychiatrists that came up with this theory that depression might be caused by an imbalance of a brain chemical such as noradrenaline or serotonin in the 1960s. But it was the pharmaceutical industry that really ran with this idea and promoted it to the public in the 1990s when they were marketing the SSRI antidepressants, which then were a new generation of drugs for emotional problems. And they wanted something that they wanted an idea that would distinguish these new drugs from the benzodiazepines that had got a very bad reputation because it had become apparent that many people had become dependent on them. And they were being widely overprescribed just to numb the difficulties of everyday life. So the pharmaceutical industry really wanted to present their new generation of antidepressants in a different way. And they did that by persuading people that they had a brain problem, a brain condition, a chemical imbalance in their brain that would be rectified by these new drugs, so that they were able to sort of draw a line between the idea of numbing your emotions with a benzodiazepine and taking one of these new sophisticated targeted drugs that was nothing like that, that worked by correcting your underlying chemical imbalance.
Yeah, even after that article came out and I saw some of the pushback articles or dismissing articles on it, I went online and I found several websites that were talking about the chemical imbalance, and this is what we offer, like institutions or hospitals, psychiatric hospitals, and it's on their website. Like, this is, we offer psychiatric medications, and it's believed that there's a chemical imbalance that leads to mental illnesses, and you can find it all over online, still.
Yeah. And I think an important point to make as well is that even where it's not explicitly described, it is implied. So and I think that's the case when most doctors present antidepressants to patients nowadays too. So they may, I mean, some I'm sure still do, but there are many doctors who probably don't tell their patients explicitly that they have a chemical imbalance. But they imply it by not explaining that antidepressants could be doing something quite different from rectifying a biological, an abnormal biological process or acting on a biological mechanism, that they could be actually changing the normal state of your brain, alcohol does, and causing mental alterations that are then superimposed onto your underlying feelings. So numbing your feelings in some way. And, you know, unless people are given that explanation of what drugs might be doing, they will believe that they're being given something to target an underlying process. And I think that's what doctors want to believe still, even though no underlying mechanism for depression has been demonstrated, whether that's an abnormality of serotonin or an abnormality of something else. And very many theories have been put forward to fill the place of the serotonin theory since we published our paper. So people have been suggesting that depression might be to do with abnormal nerve regeneration mechanisms something to do with inflammation or gut hormones. All sorts of theories been put forward, and then sort of vague speculations that, you know, it's just something to do with everything in the brain and serotonin's a little bit involved, but so are lots of other things in theories that aren't really even theories because they're not testable. They're just saying, well, it's to do with everything. It's just to do with the brain.
For the proponents, the doctors that want to believe, the psychiatrists that are prescribing these in high demand, let's say, I would imagine that for them, like I talked with Dr. Ronald Pies, I'm sure you've heard of him or you know who he is. He seems to take a quite a nuanced perspective and a conservative approach to prescribing, at least from what I can tell or what I understand. And he would say that like mild to moderate depression, maybe first line of treatment is therapy. More severe cases of depression, antidepressants are going to be recommended, maybe necessary. And I'm simplifying this. It would be a more drawn out conversation, but is the idea that, well, even though we don't necessarily know how these things work or the underlying mechanism or the mechanism of change, let's say, we do believe that they work. And so that's why we're justifying the prescription of them? Or what would you say about that?
So a couple of things. I mean, one thing is that, I think quite a lot of doctors and the NICE guidelines, that you know, the main guidelines that people follow in the UK, suggest that antidepressants shouldn't be first line treatment for mild depression, certainly, and that for moderate depression there might be lots of other alternatives. The problem is, you know, the rates of prescribing are still going up and up. So, you know, as long as they're there on the menu and they're not discouraged, they will be used. And there are plenty of psychiatrists around the place saying that actually they're underused and there's nothing wrong with the fact that almost one in five people in the UK and the US are taking antidepressants. So that's one point to make. But we really need to think about this much touted claim that antidepressants work. This was one of the main responses to our serotonin paper, that it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what they're doing. It just matters that they work. Okay. First of all, I would say it matters a lot what they're doing. But first of all, let's park that for a minute and come back to it. First of all, let's just analyze, unpick what is meant by the claim that antidepressants work. So the research that establishes that antidepressants work, supposedly, consists of placebo-controlled trials that show that antidepressants overall reduce people's depression rating scale scores a little bit more than a placebo. The difference is very small. Almost certainly it has no clinical significance. If you judge that, the level of difference by other measures of whether it makes a difference to people, it doesn't count. And it's, I would say, very likely to be explained by amplified placebo effects. So in some of these studies, not in all, but in many antidepressant studies, people can guess better than chance, people can guess whether they're taking the antidepressant or the placebo. Maybe not perfectly, but better than you would expect by chance. And that's because they get side effects, that is, noticeable effects. And they may not even register as side effects. They may just feel a bit different and be aware that they're taking a drug, an active drug, rather than the inert placebo. And that's especially likely to occur as well because people in trials have often had antidepressants before, so they sort of know what they're looking for. And we know that what people think they are taking, if people who believe they are getting an active drug do much better than people who believe they're getting an inactive substance, regardless of what they're actually getting. There are several trials that show that very clearly, that the difference between someone who thinks they're taking the active drug and someone who thinks they're taking the placebo is really substantial, and in trials where there's actually no effect of the active drug at all. So I would say that actually we do not have good evidence that antidepressants work. We have this small difference between antidepressants and a placebo, which I think is probably an amplified placebo effect. But it may also be down to the fact that antidepressants are active drugs. Drugs that change the normal state of the brain, change our normal brain chemistry, and therefore make us feel a bit different. And one of the characteristic alterations they produce is emotional numbing, or restriction or dampening of emotions. So people who've taken antidepressants often say that they can't cry, for example, and they don't feel happy anymore. They may not feel so sad anymore, but they don't feel happy anymore either. And of course, that's likely to affect people's depression rating scale scores when they are taken in these placebo-controlled trials. But that is a very different situation, as I suggested before, from the situation where from a situation where a drug is being taken to address an underlying abnormality, an underlying defect or something that, that needs to be corrected or that it would be beneficial to correct. And I think if we honestly presented antidepressants like that to people and also explained that, you know, these brain-altering substances actually haven't been very well researched. We're not very confident about their long-term, you know, the long-term risks. We don't have terribly good evidence about that. Then I think a lot of people would be much less inclined to take them than they would be if they're told, you know, this is going to put something right. You've got something wrong with your brain and this is going to put it right. Of course, you'd take something if you're told that, wouldn't you?
Yeah. Can you this is a good point. Can you tell us a little bit about the drug-centered model versus the disease-centered model?
Yeah, so the drug-centered model is this idea that drugs don't target an underlying mechanism. The disease-centered model, I should probably start with, is this idea that drugs work by targeting an underlying mechanism that produces the symptoms of a condition. So, and that is how most drugs in general medicine work. So the drug in your inhaler, the Ventolin or salbutamol that you take for wheezing, for asthma, works by relaxing the overconstricted bronchioles, the overconstricted airways, and therefore enabling you to breathe better. So it's reversing a pathological mechanism that is producing the symptom of wheezing. And so the disease-centered model in psychiatry is that idea imported into psychiatry. So it's the idea that that drugs work by targeting some underlying mechanism, whether that's a chemical imbalance or abnormal generation of nerve cells or nerve connections or inflammatory processes or whatever it is. The drug-centered model is the idea that drugs, psychiatric drugs specifically, cross the blood-brain barrier and change the normal state of the brain, change our normal brain chemistry, normal brain activity and functioning, and therefore change our normal mental states. And the drug-centered model points out that psychiatric drugs will do this in anyone who takes them, regardless of whether or not they have a psychiatric diagnosis. So like if we have a drink of alcohol, alcohol, you know, affects most people who take it. Obviously, there are individual variations and the effects differ to some extent too. But in general, alcohol changes people's mental states, changes people's emotional states and changes people's behavior. And it does that because it's altering our brain chemistry and our brain activity. And psychiatric drugs are doing the same thing. They don't necessarily, I'm not saying they have exactly the same effects as alcohol. Obviously, they don't. They're different chemical substances. They have a range of different effects depending on the particular chemical. And if we think about antidepressants, they come from a whole range of different chemical classes. So they actually cause a whole range of different sorts of alterations. But many of them, probably most of them, do have this feature of inducing emotional numbing. Which of course, you know, is likely to interact with the extreme emotional states and distress that people present with in psychiatric care.
Yeah, I like the way that you delineate those two in two different, very different frameworks for this work. In the beginning, you mentioned that you are critical of the overprescription of psychiatric medication. Do you prescribe in your daily practice? Is there still room for that with the drug-centered model of care? Like, is there, we have something that I'll just keep it simple. Absolutely.
No, thank you. So thank you for giving me the opportunity to say this, because that's important. So I think that some psychiatric drugs can be useful in some situations, depending on the sort of effects they produce. So, for example, when someone comes into hospital and is acutely manic, really manic, that means they're over aroused, they haven't slept for several weeks, they're rushing around all over the place, they're completely disinhibited, they're talking 10 to the dozen. It is useful to give them some sort of sedative to help them sleep, to bring them down to earth, to try and stop them spending the rest of their money and getting themselves into more and more social difficulties. And there are various drugs with sedative effects that can be effective in that situation. Now, when someone is acutely psychotic and they are preoccupied with delusional ideas and hallucinations, sometimes those psychotic experiences can be dampened down by various drugs that including what we refer to as antipsychotic drugs, which are sedatives, but also but have a particular property of not just sending people to sleep, but of reducing neurological activity and cognitive activity and dampening down emotions, so that people may still be awake but are dampened down to enough of a degree that they are not necessarily completely overwhelmed and preoccupied by their psychotic symptoms. So I think antipsychotic drugs can be useful when people are acutely psychotic, and sometimes also for people who are chronically psychotic, although they don't work in everyone. And there are some people who are chronically psychotic they don't work very well in, but there are others who they do. So those are examples of where I think there are drugs that have effects that can be useful in certain situations. I'm not convinced that antidepressants are very useful. Giving someone who's depressed a drug that numbs your emotions may bring a bit of relief, but the placebo-controlled trials of antidepressants, which show that antidepressants probably are simply amplified placebos, suggests that those emotional numbing effects are not really significantly beneficial for people.
I read Dr. Irving Kirsch's work, The Emperor's New Drugs, and I was quite taken aback by how significant the placebo, how small the differences are between placebo and antidepressant trials. That was very interesting to read that.
Yeah. And I think that's really important to bear in mind, because of course, you know, many people have taken antidepressants and other psychiatric drugs and will say they were fantastic, they were really effective, they saved my life. We just don't know whether that's the case unless we look at the placebo control trials, because we know that there is a placebo effect. And of course, there's just a natural recovery effect as well. It's not all down to the belief in the drug, but some of it is, at least in the short term. It's important that we don't confuse that with a pharmacological effect, because it's really important that we don't start people on drugs that are unnecessary, particularly if they're going to stay on those, end up staying on those drugs for years and years, which is what happens with antidepressants. So 50% of the people who take antidepressants in the US have been on them for 5 years. So, you know, they end up on these drugs long term. The drugs have not been investigated for long-term use. We don't have good research on, you know, that shows that they're safe if they're used for that sort of amount of time. And actually, we've got lots of indications that they are harmful, and that there are lots of problems if you end up taking them for that length of time, not least dependency, physical dependence and withdrawal symptoms, and sexual dysfunction.
Yeah. Can I ask, what do you think of the biopsychosocial model? And do you think that that is, just what do you think of the biopsychosocial model?
Sorry, I just turned my phone on so I don't get interrupted again. The biopsychosocial model. So at one level, at a rather trivial level, of course, it is true. Everything, you know, we are biological creatures. We have feelings and thoughts and emotions and reactions, and we make choices and live our lives because we have brains, because we have bodies, but also because we have large brains, and our large brains enable us to react to the world in a flexible way. And emotions are one of the ways that we react to our environment. So at one level, of course, everything is biopsychosocial. But I think it's misleading, because I think it implies that there is a specific biological causal element to mental disorders. And I would dispute that. First of all, we haven't found it. And secondly, if you think about conditions where there is a specific neurological cause, a condition like Parkinson's disease, for example, that is quite different from something like depression. And I also think it's extremely harmful to tell people that they have something that is like Parkinson's disease, or to tell them something that they may interpret as meaning that they have something that is like Parkinson's disease. Because generally, you know, most neurological conditions are incurable.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's helpful to think through.
And just another point on that's maybe helpful as well is, you know, if we... as psychiatrists, of course, we always want to rule out physical conditions, don't we? Physical causes of mental disorders, which, you know, which is a perfectly appropriate thing to do. But when we find them, we've then got a different situation. So, you know, if you find that someone who is you thought was depressed has hypothyroidism, for example, you then treat their thyroid problem. You don't then send them off for marital therapy or long-term psychological therapy, you know, and try and probe why they're depressed. You treat the thyroid problem. So, you know, those. I think that helps to show that a case of depression in general is completely different from a physical condition. And when we find a physical condition, it then becomes a different scenario.
Did you think similarly to this when you came into psychiatry, or what was it that was kind of a light bulb moment for you? If you had something like that, what is it that brought you here?
I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I was always argumentative and challenging. So I was reading Thomas Sazz at medical school. so there wasn't a light bulb moment about it, or, about the nature of psychiatry or mental conditions, but my thoughts about psychiatric drugs evolved over time. And there was many light bulb moments, I would say. I mean, it started, I suppose, from the fact that when I first started in psychiatry, that's in the early 1990s, I was working in the last days of the old asylums. And there were still wards there that were full of people who were very chronic long-term patients who were drugged up to the eyeballs, shuffling around, zombified, subdued. And it seemed quite clear to me that you know, the drugs had done something to them, but they hadn't cured them. They hadn't restored these people to normal. So that was something that sort of helped the evolution of my thinking about drug treatment. Another time, another light bulb moment for me over drugs again was talking to a senior registrar, a more senior doctor who I was working with, and we were talking about antidepressants, and I was saying, you know, I just don't really see any effects with people. I don't see why everyone else thinks they're so effective. You know, some people come in and take them and sometimes they get better. Sometimes they don't get better. When they get better, there are usually other explanations. I just don't understand how people have come to the conclusion that they're really, that they're that beneficial. And he said, oh, they're just amplified placebos. Go and read this paper by Richard Thompson from 1983. And Richard Thompson wrote about how they were amplified placebos and identified a small number of trials that had compared antidepressants with active placebos, generally finding no difference. So that was a light bulb moment for me.
Mm. Yeah. And
I'm glad you have absences like that as well.
Yeah. I had three different things going and now they're all gone. I know. That's what it was. When you were, let's say, like on your residency or something, you were already in med school, you were reading Thomas Sotts and thinking through these things. Did you ever have to deal with pressure to, like, I think from a supervisor or a superior, like, this, I think we need to prescribe in this case, but you felt like prescribing wasn't the right answer? Or did you ever have to go against kind of, did you have to work through that? You know what I mean?
So two things. Yes, a lot. And I think many, many junior psychiatrists feel that. You feel very uncomfortable about some of the decisions that that they make or feel forced to make. But I would also say that I think when I was training in psychiatry, there was more debate. And senior psychiatrists were more open-minded than now. I think there are plenty of open-minded psychiatrists now, actually, but I think there is a leadership that has become more defensive and more narrowly focused on biological models and biological approaches.
I
think to that extent it was easier, and I had senior psychiatrists who were were happy to debate the nature of mental disorder and certainly to think about whether there were alternatives to drug treatment. I mean, a good example, okay, is when I first started, the general approach to treating someone with psychosis was to admit them for 2 weeks to the ward and not give them any medication for two whole weeks. I mean, you'd never do that now, but there was an understanding that some people would get better without medication and that it was a very serious thing to label someone with a psychotic disorder or schizophrenia and start them on treatment that may well end up being lifelong. So I think, I think times have changed because of all sorts of pressures which make it more difficult now to go against that very medical, biomedical status quo.
You said pressures. I was, in my head it popped, I was thinking, I don't know, around the time Thomas Sotts wrote his books, like the Myth of Mental Illness, was debate more common, but then after that, people started questioning psychiatry, like, why are they even around? And then psychiatry, in turn, it was more common for psychiatrists to be more defensive of their position or their turf, or was that just one pressure? There's other pressures too, like...
Absolutely, I think that's one of them. There's a really good article by a historian about the origins of the DSM. And he says, Daniel Wilson, I think, someone Wilson anyway, he says that there are a number of drivers that produce DSM-3 and mean that DSM-3 is a much more biological document, and it's a sort of flagship of a new biological psychiatry. And one of the drivers is the anti-psychiatry movement, and so it's a reaction to that. It's a sort of defensive reaction to a perceived threat. But another driver, he says, particularly operative in the US, is that therapy, particularly psychoanalysis, used to be restricted to a psychiatrist, to medically qualified doctors. Then that was overturned in the 70s sometime. And so cheaper therapists basically come in and provide competition. So psychiatrists have to then differentiate themselves in a they have to carve out a new territory in order to differentiate themselves from non-medically qualified therapists, and therefore hence the move towards biological psychiatry. And then finally, managed care coming in the US, which again tends to favor cheaper forms of care. And so again, psychiatrists have to bring something special to the table to justify their mm-hmm. salaries and their prestige and status, and therefore end up prioritizing biological treatments, particularly of course drugs that they can prescribe and others can't.
If psychiatrists across the board were, let's say, nervous about all of that, like if every psychiatrist thought the same way that you do, would there still be as prominent a need for psychiatrists?
I mean, I think psychiatry should be a much smaller enterprise.
Okay.
And probably a different enterprise as well. But certainly I think that the vast majority of people that currently see psychiatrists shouldn't be in a medical system. Hmm. They should be in a system that's situated or located in social services or something like that, so that they can get help for their individual life problems rather than treatment for a fictitious diagnosis with potentially harmful medical treatments. There are, of course, people who need specialist care and who, as I suggested earlier, may well benefit from medication like antipsychotic drugs or sedative drugs. There are people who need hospitalization and containment and care for short periods, and some people for long periods. So there's a need for specialist care, specialist mental health care of some sort. And some of that involves medical interventions. So to that extent, there's a role for something like psychiatry, I would say. Hmm. But certainly that's much smaller than psychiatry, than the area that psychiatry covers today.
Yeah. Yeah, that's helpful. I've been thinking through, I brought up the biopsychosocial model earlier, and I know there's a whole definitional debate around the word disease. And there's some I've talked to is the thought is we shouldn't be treating mental health concerns with medical solutions or medications or whatever that might be. And then there are others who are more along the lines of, well, it is a biopsychosocial thing and we have these biological medications. And if that can help improve, then that's, you know, what needs to happen. So I'm just thinking through all of this as I'm talking to multiple people in this avenue. So it's helpful to hear your thoughts.
So if we think about the drug-centered model, the drug-centered model is about using drugs to modify behavior. So it's not a medical model. You're using a medical intervention, but not in a medical way. You're not treating a disease. You're modifying someone's behavior. As you might modify behavior by, you know, by drinking alcohol or taking other sorts of substances. I think that's a good way of distinguishing the two. There is a role for some medical intervention, but we're not treating diseases, in my view. And I think we need to be very clear about that, because I think when we start telling people that we're treating diseases, we give people messages that are not helpful, that actually can induce chronicity and lead to poor outcomes.
Yeah. Thank you. That's very helpful. Thank you. Last question. I just wanted to ask about the Critical Psychiatry Network and any, like, what's going on there? Any, exciting things happening, future plans, stuff like that?
Yes, thank you. So the Critical Psychiatry Network is a group of psychiatrists, mainly psychiatrists, but some medical students and other medical doctors, who take a skeptical or critical view of mainstream biomedical psychiatry. There isn't a single view, though. There are several hundred members now all over the world, although mostly focused in the UK, but all over the world. And there is a variety of views within the network. We occasionally have put in evidence on to government reports or government initiatives, reviews, and things of mental health legislation, and to NICE reviews. And we run conferences and meetings, educational meetings. So we have one coming up at the beginning of April, which next week, in fact, which will be interesting. And then we'll have another one the following year and maybe some educational meetings in the meantime.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you. Dr. Moncrief, thank you for coming on and joining me. I've really benefited from and enjoyed this conversation.
It's a pleasure. Nice to talk to you, Daniel.